I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance. Today, February 10, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland. Cornish. Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson. Meslow. Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here.
We do have the presence of a quorum, so we'll take a look at the minutes from the meeting of February 9, 2005. They're in the packet. Representative Newman moves approval of those. Any questions or discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. All right, members, we have two items on the agenda. I see the paper agenda in the packet lists only one, but we first will go to the Department of Corrections, after which we will take up the tax court. So I'd ask Commissioner Fabian, Deputy Commissioner Benson, Deputy Commissioner Nelson, if you want to come forward. And we're in your hands and at your mercy. So go ahead and proceed.
Hopefully we've come well prepared here. Yes, I see that. Okay, Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe that the governor's budget for the Department of Corrections reflects a strong commitment on his part to public safety, as evidenced by the resources that are being recommended to us in this very difficult budget cycle. The department's primary functions are to serve public safety by incarcerating the most serious of the state's offenders, providing opportunities for them to change, and also in providing effective supervision of offenders in the community. We believe that this is a core responsibility of the of state government. There are three major changes, change areas driving the increases. And one is the acute shortage of prison beds currently and projected over the next 2 years. The escalating prison health care costs and a major commitment to enhance the entire system of managing the state's most serious sex offenders. We go to the overhead. We've got one. I just thought it would be interesting to put in a snapshot of the general fund spending. And if you note on the overhead, corrections funding is 3% of the state's budget. Our agency mission is to hold offenders accountable in prison and under community supervision and offer opportunities for change while restoring for victims, restoring justice for victims and contributing to a safer Minnesota. We do this by fostering community partnerships, using best practices. Significant research has been done in that area into what works, and we are trying to implement that, creating a respectful, diverse culture, utilizing effective communication, and strategic and efficient and cost-efficient use of our resources. This overhead was just to show you that our budget request supports three major program areas. The facilities division takes up 72% of our budget, community services 24%, and our operation support is about 4%. I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Benson here to talk about the facilities and the budget related.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dennis Benson, a Deputy Commissioner responsible for the Institutions Division. And several of these slides you've seen before, but we'll go through them quickly to reacquaint you with kind of the some of the locations of our institutions. The map here suggests that we have 8 adult institutions, Moose Lake, Willow River, where we also have the CIP camp. That's a level 3 facility. St. Cloud is a level 4 facility and also our intake facility. Rush City is a level 4, our newest correctional facility that was designed for double bunking and has about 1,000 beds. And we have Stillwater, Oak Park Heights. Stillwater is a level 4. Oak Park is our only level 5 institution. Shakopee is our only female institution, and we have levels 1 through 5 at Shakopee. And then Faribault, of course, is our level 3 institution where we have the bonding project that we've been discussing. We also have 2 juvenile facilities, Thistledew Camp in northern Minnesota and Red Wing. This next slide you've also seen before, but wanted to just put you in touch one more time with the hard work that the agency has done to lower our per diem. We've tried to do that responsibly, but we've made good progress from 1996 to 2004. We're down to $76.80 a day at the close of the last fiscal year. This next slide you've also seen before, but again, especially to the right of the line, you get an opportunity to look one more time at the significant population increases that we can expect, not only the next biennium, but out into the future. And I would add again that these numbers do not include any sentencing initiatives that are currently on the table. This reflects just current law and policy, sentencing policy, as we know it.
I'm Harlan Nelson, Deputy Commissioner of Community and Field Services. I'll take this next slide. In our overview, we mentioned that the system is a partnership with the counties. There's 31 Community Corrections Act counties that provide direct supervision in the community. Of those, there are 16 agencies. There's multi-counties that are grouped together. The other 56 counties, the services are provided by the Department of Corrections for felonies, and in half of those, they also, the Department of Corrections does the adult misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and juveniles under contract with the counties. The other half of those 56 counties, CPO counties, correctional probation officers under the direction of the judges, provide the juvenile and adult misdemeanor and adult gross misdemeanor services. The direct supervision, intensive supervision, there's 126,000 that are under probation. There's an additional 4,000 under supervised release. Just to let you know how that breaks out, there's about 38,000 adult felons under supervision. There's 32,000 adult gross misdemeanors under probation, and there's 41,000 adult misdemeanors of that group. 16,000 under supervision are juveniles of that 126,000. The intensive supervision is ISR, which we have by statute. It's very intensive supervision. You have one to each 15 offenders. They have house arrest originally when they come out. If they're level 3 sex offenders, we're putting them on GPS that I'll be talking about a little later. They could be on electronic home confinement, which is not the GPS system, but another system. And they are supervised very intensively throughout the community. The state has about half of that, but we also have ISR that is contracted out to several of the larger counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, Dakota, St. Louis County. The also under community services, institution community work crew, this was started with about a $700,000 funding that's a revolving fund where we partner with housing, low-income housing, and affordable housing communities. We have started our 200th house, is under construction now, and it's been very receptive and received well in the communities. Sentencing to service, there's 139 sentence to service crews. The county run about 80, the state about 59 of those crews. 74 out of 87 counties have sentence to service crews working in them. It's very well received. They do a lot of additional works from cleaning up ditches and to shoveling walks and for the elderly to all kinds of cleaning up of parks and so forth. They're usually doing work that would not be done otherwise. The work release. We're averaging now about 220 a day. That's putting some relief to the prison bed populations. We contract out in halfway houses and local jails to do those work release programs. Right now, I think we're at an all-time high of about 250 out there under the work release program. Grants and subsidies unit, there's about 300 contracts. There's about $65 million that go out to the counties. There's about $11 million that's caseload reduction, $36 million in this Community Corrections Act subsidy. This is on an annual basis. There's about $4.3 million is CPO, County Probation Officer reimbursement. $3.7 million goes out to intensified sex offender supervision. The intensive sex offender supervision is usually, we wanted it to be at about 1 to 35, but with pressure in that area, it's gone to 1 to 40, 1 to 45. They're all specially trained as part of that policy to deal with sex offenders. The Department of Corrections does that training. The Interstate Compact, clients coming from other states, clients leaving from other states. It's approximately 2,000 that are in our state from other places and about 2,000 that are being supervised by other states for us who had committed the crime in our state. Licensing and inspection, there's 90 in-state facilities that are being licensed by the Department of Corrections under the umbrella rule. There's about 25 outpatient. There's 9 adult halfway houses that are inspected and 100 secure facilities with one private prison that's inspected by the Department of Corrections in the state of Minnesota. Program support, evaluation, research, and technical assistance. This is an area that we're probably strained quite a bit with some of the cutbacks of 2003, so we have a difficult time to provide the number of staff to do the evaluation and research that we need, and this is an area that's of concern. Sex offender CD services. We have community notification, sex offender assessment. That group has been doing a tremendous job here this past year. There's been a tremendous volume that's gone through. 1,400 cases are screened down out of the 8,000 prisoners of that group. There's over 240-some predatory offender reports that have been done, and of that, 170 cases were forwarded to the county attorneys to have that legal screen as far as the potential for civil commitment. Also part of that is community notification. That has increased dramatically since 1997, where 468 subjects came out. We're now looking at over 1,000 releases that go through an ECR, End of Confinement Review Committee, to rank their risk to reoffend, either level 1, 2, or 3, with 3 being the highest level. And they are now managing over 5,000 files under the...
excuse me, but we have a question on your last slide, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess in your comments, you were talking about licensing and inspection, and I thought I heard right, and maybe you could explain. You said you inspect over 100 secure facilities in the state?
Yes, these are local jails and
okay, so that's what I was going to ask. What are those facilities that
local jails, small lockups, city lockups, and so forth are.
Okay, so those are like
county and city
jails now. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
and the next one I've on the book right now is probation population, and this shows that there it hopefully is a leveling off, that we still are at capacity with our caseloads. That's still a concern. This has happened over the last 15 to 20 years that those caseloads have risen. And so we're looking here, but hopefully it's starting to level off. We have one of the highest rates per 100 per capita in the nation as far as having people under supervision.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, I didn't get the number for juveniles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, of those under supervision, about 16,000 of them are juveniles throughout the state, and that's a combination of Department of Corrections, County Probation Officers, and Community Corrections Act counties.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, if I added, or commissioners, if I added the 126,710 prisoners, or probationers, and the prison inmates, 8,333, and the something release, sentence to release, or whatever, SR I put, 4,000, and the 16,000 juveniles, and added those up, would that number be the number that makes up the
majority of money that's spent in that 3% on your first slide?
That would not necessarily be the majority of that money that's spent on the 3%. The prison institutions in there are a large portion of that. And you also realize that the state and county are partners in that, so there's county tax levy dollars that are also included that are not in that first slide. That's just state dollars when you're looking at the first slide.
State dollars. And the institutions are, maintaining the institutions and the programs there
are included in that first slide. That's correct.
Okay. But would that give me a pretty good, if I added those numbers, would that give me the numbers of people that are involved primarily in...
Yeah. Yes.
In the state and county and local, they committed crime and now they're paying off their time, kind of?
The probationers, the supervised releasees, the prison population. You also have local jails and workhouses that are around 6,000 some. And you would add those numbers in. The dollars that you're looking at are state dollars. There's additional dollars that come from the counties, which has always been the case.
Right. Thank you. I was trying to get a total amount of people that are involved in the system, either on the local, county, or state level.
That would do it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we can try to break that out for you, because even in the 6,000 that Harley mentioned that were in the jails, a lot of them could be reflected on these probation caseloads, so there would be duplication. But we certainly can break it all out for you so we have a number that...
I'd appreciate that, because it's, Mr. Chair, because it's climbing so fast and so much. And when I started a long time ago, it seemed like we were never going, we were always the lowest, and we were never going to get to 10,000. And I know that, you know, 126,000 saving us from getting to the 10,000, but, or we were going for the 10,000 and then they left, but we're getting to 10,000 within the state prisons, and that scares me so much, because I just think we're getting to be too much.
Representative Murphy, I agree with you. I think added into that informational mix, and I won't say however, but I believe, commissioners, that Minnesota, the ranking that I've seen nationwide, is still 49th in the number of prisoners incarcerated per 100,000 population in the United States.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And I believe we're second, or first, but I think second in number of folks on probation and not therefore not incarcerated, with the same ranking of our sister states.
Mr. Chair, we're about fourth in the nation.
Fourth. Okay. So we still maintain, Representative Murphy, really good numbers. I think, however, one of the caveats is Minnesota is third highest in recent incarcerations rate in that same review I saw, and that's due to, in large part, to methamphetamine explosion. I think that's what I've read, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask you a question about that observation. When you say recent, are you saying that within the last 2-3 years, we now have one of the highest rates of incarceration if you look within a limited amount of time?
I think I will have to dig the information out, Representative Ellison. We still are 49th in overall incarceration per population. The numbers of arrests and therefore incarcerations has crept up. Our rate has. Our ranking has not, but I think our rate has, and I believe it's due in large part to the methamphetamine explosion that we've seen. I'll dig out the article. I thought it came in late in the year, but I just thought I'd mention that. Representative Murphy.
And I think another factor is what I mentioned before, is that we're spending fewer dollars on prevention than we did in the past.
I can't share any knowledge right now, but that certainly is an issue. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, I'd like to know how many people are released every year. Is it about the same every year? And
Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, this past year we released 6,000 people from our correctional system. Now that would be supervised release and also probation or parole violators, supervised release violators that came in and got back out. So with a system of 8,300 people, that's a pretty significant number, and we always try to emphasize the fact that about 95% of our people in our correctional facilities are coming home again someday. So we do lots of releases.
So for that thin period of time, just the 6,000 released compared to how many coming in the same period of time?
Mr. Chair and Representative Soderstrom members, well, the population continues to go up, so my obviously the number coming in is slightly more than the number going out. Last year, for instance, I think it was about 700 more came in than went out. So
Representative Soderstrom.
But 6,000, you're talking to be released from, I'm sorry, commissioners, 6,000, that's not just from prison, but that's from release from probation also? I mean, that's actually from your prison systems, you actually released 6,000 last year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, correct.
Thank you.
And in your portion of our budget book, I'm just noting that, in the public safety portion of our budget book, there's a number of 94% of the people locked up in Itasca County. Not to pick on Itasca County, but it's in the book. 94% of the people are either on meth or have meth on them. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, so there's about 7,000 new entries into prison every year, roughly. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, last year, for example, our intake was about 700 and a few more than what we released. So,
you released six. How many did you release?
Well, we released about 6,000.
Okay, so there'd be 6,700, something like that. Of the prisoners that are coming into the prison system, how many have been there before?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the number of supervised release violators coming in, I believe, makes up about less than 30%, but about 30% are release violators, so they have been in before now. Of the others that come in, certainly some would come in with a previous felony history. I don't have that number available to me, but we can certainly get that.
Okay, proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is Operation Support, the employee development, which is training, information technology, CrimNet, legal services, financial services, and human resources. This is just up here to mention it's about 4% of the budget, which we feel is a very acceptable for administrative type of overview. So that's what that slide is about.
And Mr. Chair and members, we're going to get into our chain item requests now. For the 06-07 budget. These are obviously are all part of the governor's budget. The first one, and probably, well, undoubtedly the most significant, is our inmate population base adjustment. The total amount is $71.2 million for the biennium. In 06, we're needing $28.759 million to rent beds. All of the new admissions now coming into our system have to go to a rented bed as we are at capacity. The number, the marginal cost there, including the rent and our costs, comes to $69.85. In fiscal year 07, the number is $42.447 million, and that 1,640 number includes the 1,128 from 06, but the number, there's a little inflation factor there as our, we have a 2%, I believe, inflator on our contract with Prairie Correctional Facility, so it's $70.91. And again, this is the largest change item, but it's there's going to be no secret here as we move through the biennium in terms of how many offenders come in and how much it costs to rent those beds.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes slightly to this slide, but slightly to one of the slides in the beginning. I'm following up on Representative Eastland's question about the per diem and the way they're reported. I actually reviewed the statute because I had nothing better to do with my time. And I was looking, and it did say that the commissioner shall ensure that these new per diem methods are used in all future annual reports to the legislature and are also reflected in the department's biennial budget document. So my question to you is which way of figuring per diem is this? Is it the way that Representative Eastland had asked about before? Is it a different way? I'm just not sure.
Mr. Chair, yes. And Representative Hillstrom, the per diem that is reflected on the chart that we saw earlier does not include the other costs. You should have, or if you haven't, you will be getting a copy of our biannual report, and in that biannual report it has all of the costs consistent with the statute. The central office costs, I believe there's some bonding costs included in there as well. But again, the per diem chart that you saw is consistent what we report to the corrections yearbook, and that is a very consistent measure across the nation. That's why we report it that way, because other states do as well. It was the statute was changed, I believe, back in, I'm not exactly sure, 97, 98, 99, to include some of those other costs, and they wanted it reported that way in our annual report. And I believe there may be some reference that says that those costs should be noted in our budget book. And I believe we may have neglected to include that this year. However, it is in the annual report.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Just to follow up with this, again, I photocopied the section, but it does say that you shall report that it should be reflected in the department's biannual budget document. And so that's the only reason why I was asking. And then I was questioning about the also the report. That was due on January 15th, and we're going to get that now, or I'm just not certain of the timing? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it's been approved. The commissioner approved it recently, and it should be over here.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, this next chart just indicates the average prison population for each of the years going forward. And again, this number is a little bit different because as we make our budget request, we use an average number for the year, and that's different from the population projections. We just wanted to point that out, but as we put together our budget request, you can see the number of beds that are unfunded in 05. Obviously, we have a problem this year, and that's what gave rise to our deficiency budget request. And then, again, moving into 06, the 1128 includes the 341, and then in 07, the 1640 includes 1128. Mr. Chair and members, as I have noted previously in hearings, another area that we are significantly underfunded at this point is our health services area. Healthcare in prisons is no different from health care in the community in that it is rising dramatically. Obviously, that's being driven by our rising population as well. We've kind of broken it down here in terms of how we get to 4.42 million per year, but one of the significant drivers here is the supplies and equipment for on-site medical treatment. Back in 1999, we were getting about $145 per offender for these items, and because of costs and inflation and lack of funding dollars, in 2005 we're at about $72 per offender. So we've got a significant deficiency in that area. Offender health care intake has increased about 40%. Sick calls have increased approximately 25% in our institutions. Of course, medications are increasing in terms of cost. And we also have, as we've noted before, about 21-25% of our males are using some type of psychotropic med, and about 40% of females are using some type of psychotropic med. We also have approximately 400 staff in the healthcare area. In years gone by, we had a very high turnover rate in healthcare professionals, primarily our registered nurses. But a couple of years ago, we, through negotiating a newer contract, that turnover slowed way down. And that was a good thing because our population was continuing to increase. We now only have about 11% annually, and we were hours short of dollars in that budget category. We've also moved away from 24-hour-a-day nursing coverage in all of our facilities except two, and we have tried to absorb as much of this cost as we can, but obviously it has become a problem for us, and it's a hole that we simply have to fill with respect to providing constitutionally required health care to our population. We also have a $500,000 increase through our contract because, again, of the cost of those major medical expenses that occur in a community of 8,300 offenders. And then last, with respect to the health care piece, there's about $200,000 in increased costs for dental. We are experiencing a dramatic increased workload with respect to what the methamphetamine offenders have brought into the correctional system. But in addition to that, just sheer numbers are driving the need for additional dental services as well. And then the last item in the healthcare change item is the federal funds that need to be replaced. For many years now, we have been funded by the federal government to provide chemical dependency treatment to offenders in several of our locations. That's primarily been through RSAT funding, and that funding is going away in the federal budget. And we simply have to keep pace with our current number of treatment beds, we need $920,000 annually to make up for those lost federal funds. So that, in a nutshell, is the problems that we're experiencing in our health care budget.
Hold that slide. Representative Eastland, you had a question? And then Hill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe you might have alluded to it, Mr. Benson, but it says intakes have increased 40% since 2002. Sick calls have increased 25%. The calls and the intakes are increasing faster than the prison population is growing. Is there a particular reason for that? You said something about that maybe the type of inmate, the methamphetamine stuff. Maybe they need more health care. I'm not sure, but why would it be that there's been an increase in access points to the medical.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, we have our health services director here. We're going to let her answer that question.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nanette Schrader. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And Representative Eastland, in response to your question, when an offender comes into prison, we're required to provide a gamut of health care services to them during the initial 48, 72-hour period that they're with us. That's what we consider to be an intake. We give them a once-over kind of quick health care screening, a mental health screening, a dental screening, a CD assessment, very quick. And then as they stay with us, we would certainly provide them with a physical as well, a much more comprehensive dental exam, certainly a much more comprehensive mental health screening. The difference between the intake as well as the sick call has to do with those people who are with us for a longer period of time and get sick. We run kind of outpatient clinics, and so they would access the sick call the same as you might access your clinic as well. You're not feeling well, you have a sore throat, you want to get it taken care of, whatever. So so we've also seen a little bit of an increase, a 25% increase as a result of that.
Sure. I mean, I guess, but my question is there something that we're seeing more of in these intakes and calls that's causing that number of incidences to increase faster than the population itself is increasing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, the dramatic increase has to do with everything with the increase in population. Is that we're seeing more and more people coming in through our doors, and so we have to provide them with those services.
Commissioner Bennett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, as we have said in the past, we have increased by about a population increase of about 45% in the last 5 years, and that's really the primary driver. But Stillwater, for example, or St. Cloud, where we're now double bunking 200 additional inmates, we now have 200 in the mix that are going to sick call occasionally, and that's what's accounting for that 25% increase. In our medium custody facilities, we've added literally 400 or 500 beds by getting more beds in dorms, doing more double bunking. 10 years ago, we were double bunking about 50% of our mediums. Today, we're double bunking over 80% of our mediums. And it's just sheer numbers that's really driving the increase.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I guess what I was just questioning is, is there a health consequence to pushing to the double bunking to higher densities of population? I mean, I guess, but what you're saying is most of this change is attributable just to the increase of population and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, that's correct, but again, this year we didn't have flu vaccine, and an example, in our Stillwater facility, we got the flu, and when you get it in a cell block, just about everybody gets it, so we were able to scramble here a few weeks ago and get people vaccinated, but that drove up the visits to the sick call. And certainly the methamphetamine epidemic out there has really resulted in a dramatic increase in dental calls.
Ms. Schrader, stay there, but on another issue, but relative to the healthcare issue, Commissioner Benson, of the 8,333 prisoners incarcerated, what's the number of those that are in state owned and run operation as opposed to rented space? Can you break down that number into those two categories?
Mr. Chair and members, today we're at just under 200 at Prairie, so bring that number down by 200. And I believe we have another 94 that are in county jails. So there's roughly just under 300 that are, so about 8,000 in our system, and about 300 are either in a rented bed from a particular county, and the other 194, I believe it is, are out at the Prairie Correctional Facility.
So that's roughly just under 300 in those facilities. Does the 40% increase in health care intakes extend to both the state-run beds as well as the contracted beds?
Mr. Chair, yes. All of the offenders who go to Prairie Correctional Facility and to the jails get intaked through us first. So we have to see them. We provide all of the assessments and make sure that they're fitting the criteria. For example, the jails don't have the health care delivery system that we have. You know, they're smaller. They don't have that kind of health care. And so we're much more careful about who we send to the county jails than we are, you know, with taking our own. So there's somewhat of an adverse impact on our population. We're keeping the sick ones. We won't send somebody to the jail that's got an acute mental health condition, or we won't send somebody who's got uncontrolled diabetes. We might not send somebody, well, we won't send somebody who's hepatitis C positive, probably needing treatment. The same holds true for those offenders who we're sending to Prairie. Prairie does have some on-site medical care. It certainly, they certainly have much more than what the jails have. But as our contract says, with Prairie, we won't send them anyone who has AIDS or is receiving hepatitis C treatment or in need of an organ transplant. So again, we're doing some screenings with those offenders who we think will be transferring to one of those other places that creates an adverse impact on us.
So when the health care is required, the DOC pays for the inmate, whether they're in the state-owned or the rented bed space.
Mr. Chair, a little bit different. Prairie Correctional Facility will take care of a lot of the on-site health care, some of the off-site specialty care. They will take care of the first 48 hours of inpatient hospital care, but the department will be responsible for picking up anything beyond 48 hours. And then, of course, if they find somebody who is HIV positive and is in need of treatment, they may send them back as well, or hepatitis C, for example. The jails are completely different than that. And in fact, the three jails handle their health care very differently. Some have on-site nursing services. Some don't have any on-site health care whatsoever. One has on-site psych services. One has nothing. So it really is a blend.
So it sounds to me like the bulk of the health care cost then falls on the DOC and the state,
regardless
of where the prisoner is housed.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And that would be reflected in your per diem.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Soderstrom, then Ellison. Do you have another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering how long is your chemical dependency when you give chemical? Is it a year, or how long are they in those programs? And how many people, what percent of the population is in a drug treatment program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Soderstrom, we have a variety of chemical dependency programs in our system, and they range from anywhere from 3 months to over a year. I'm going to get my little table here quick. We currently have 800 treatment beds, and they're in a variety of different facilities. As I said, they range anywhere from 3 to 6 months to 9 to 12 months.
Thank you.
Representative Ellison.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Sutterstrom asked my question, but I do have a follow-up. How is the Department of Corrections positioned for chemical dependency services? I mean, do you have a lot of unmet need? I mean, there are a lot of people on the waiting list. Is that number adequate to service the need that you have?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, as I said, we have about 800 chemical dependency beds. Probably 90% of our population has a chemical dependency or chemical abuse problem. So 90% of 8,000 isn't 800. Yeah. So we certainly could use more beds.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Ellison.
Okay. How is AIDS and HIV impacting the health care budget for the DLC?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, we're very fortunate in Minnesota that we have a very small number of offenders who are HIV positive. When I first came to the department about 6 years ago, we had somewhere 20, 21 offenders who were HIV positive. Unfortunately, that number is going way up. We now are sitting at about 50, so it's practically doubled in 6 years. HIV is getting much more difficult to treat, but they are treated just as they would be in the community. If they meet the CDC guidelines for the cocktail, we certainly would provide that to them. HIV, however, is not really our big issue. Our big issue is hepatitis C. And given the high-risk nature of our population, hepatitis C is probably much more prevalent, well, is more prevalent than HIV.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
And it sounds like HIV-AIDS treatment is not really a budget driver for your health care costs. That's what you're saying.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, no, it's not. I mean, we still are spending somewhere between $11,000 and $13,000 per offender who gets treatment. Not all of our offenders are on medications. I think we have maybe four or five HIV-positive offenders who are not receiving medications because of various reasons.
That was, okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Very good. Wherever we were at, pick it up from there. Thank you, Mr. Schrader.
Mr. Chair, and members, just one
excuse
more.
Excuse me, Representative Easton had a question.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Commissioners, he got to talking about chemical dependency. How many inmates are in chemical dependency at any given treatment program at any given time? I mean, what is your capacity? I would assume it's at capacity.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, we currently have 800 beds. And we believe on an average year we treat roughly 1,700.
Okay, how many of those 1,700 are second time through the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we'd have to do a little research to accurately answer that.
So if a parole violator got incarcerated back into prison and they violated because their urinalysis came in positive or something, so they were guilty of using drugs, would they come back into the system and go back into another treatment cycle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, the primary driver would be how much time are they back for. If it's 30 days, they may not, but if they get 3 months or 120 days, we have a short-term program at Lionel Lakes, one of our triad programs, so they may very well go back into treatment.
So some of that 1,700 number that you're treating every year could be the same person counted more than once.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, potentially, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the other point I just wanted to make on our health care costs, as Ms. Schroeder indicated, hepatitis C really is a health care driver, and even if we don't treat those people, treatment is very expensive, but just caring for them is also very, very expensive. Those people that are not treatable that end up dying, and we've had, I believe, 5-6 a year now that are dying of end-stage liver failure as a result of hepatitis C, and that process is also very expensive.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide is labeled sex offender treatment. I should probably clarify that it should be more than just sex offender treatment. It should include assessment and some other issues as well. The $350,000, which is grants for subsidizing counties on reimbursement of sex offender assessments, is required by statute. First-time sex offenders who are not a presumptive commit to prison, it's required that they do a sex offender assessment. There was about $295,000 a year in the previous budget that was reduced in 2003 when there was $4.5 billion deficit. This money is being reinstated at $350,000. It was an issue that was mentioned in the legislative auditor's report as something that was very important to the counties to be reimbursed for this funding. $1.25 million a year for treatment of sex offenders and programming for sex offenders on supervised release. There's approximately $900,000 right now in the budget for that. It does not go far enough. This probably will also not quite get the job done, but it's a good stretch towards providing that kind of service for supervised release sex offenders to have programming for them on their release.
And Mr. Chair and members, there's also $1 million for additional treatment beds in our correctional facilities. It's our hope that if this initiative is funded, that we can add somewhere between 40 and 50 additional treatment beds at one of our higher custody institutions so that we can begin sex offender treatment at a higher custody level as well. At this time, we're considering the Stillwater facility or possibly the Rush City facility. There are sex offenders that for a variety of reasons don't or aren't eligible to get to a medium custody institution. And with these dollars, we could start an additional program at a higher custody institution, which would be very helpful. In addition to the $1 million, there's another $500,000 in the budget for supportive transitional services, where we would contract with private vendors for housing assistance, employment counseling, support groups, and community education around the sex offender issue. Again, we think that one of the areas that we need to spend more resources is that area of transition. And transitioning a sex offender is particularly difficult, not only in our system, but any system. As we all know, communities aren't wild about sex offenders moving back, but as we said earlier, about 95% of our offenders do come home. Many of those are going to be sex offenders. And if we want to make a successful transition, we really are going to have to start to put some dollars into this effort.
Question, leave the slide up. A couple questions or points. The $350,000 grant funding to counties for reimbursement of sex offender assessments is up from the last biennium by over 50%, I believe. Isn't that correct? Do you have those numbers handy? That represents more money, increase of money to the counties.
The counties had originally had about $295,000 in subsidies. That was prior to 2003. That was reduced from the budget. So there was nothing this last year for them for reimbursement. This is $350,000. So it's up by $55,000 over the $295,000.
Also, on the issue of sex offender treatment, is there a copay involved that the sex offender pays?
Yes, we have attempted to, we allow the treatment service providers to do a copay, so that does stretch the dollars and makes them go farther. It's also considered best practices to have offenders copay for their treatment, that they have an investment in it, and it's deemed as very appropriate, both from the perspective of not having the taxpayers pay the full amount, but also from the perspective of the offenders be more involved in their treatment.
What is that amount of copay, and how often is it paid?
It goes up and down depending on the offenders, but is it? Do we have any reading of that? Yeah, we're not. We'll get that number for you.
Well, isn't that the? Well, I kind of like it now, but if you don't have it, so be it. My notes indicate it's $20 to $30. And
oh, as far as what the offender himself pays, yeah. I thought you wanted the total amount.
Oh, I wanted the copay the offender pays.
Yeah, it could depend upon $20 to $30 a meeting.
Weekly. Is that best? You say that's best practices. Is that what you're referring to as best practices? Is that done elsewhere in the United States? Charging the sex offender a daily copay.
That is done elsewhere in the United States.
Do you know offhand what the range of copays are elsewhere? Where do we fall within the ranking of copays for sexual offenders?
I do not, Mr. Chairman.
Will you find out?
We will find out.
And if you can find out any reason why we can't increase that copay, I'd like to know that as well. Okay. And then we have Representative Hillstrom.
The Thunder one?
No, I'm talking about sex offenders, not public defenders. Representative Paymar, thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the comprehensive approach that we are proposing for sex offenders, are you applying for the federal grants that are out there for comprehensive approaches to sex offender management?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, we are already receiving some help from the Center for Sex Offender Management, and we will be applying for grants with them, but they've been working with our department to review all policies, procedures, and improve our sex offender management. I should say that they were somewhat complimentary in saying that we do a good job in Minnesota compared to the rest of the nation, both with treatment programs and so forth, but we are looking to improve wherever we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am aware of one that the deadline for the application is March 17th, and they have $250,000, which requires a 25% match, and then it also, not only does it help support a comprehensive approach, but then it helps jurisdictions lead the way in improving. So I hope that you'll be applying for this one, and that would increase our budget.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any one of the presenters, could you share with us how effective these treatment programs may or may not be in terms of recidivism?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have the exact figures with, but they have determined that those that have gone through treatment, and they've compared them in follow-up studies, and I don't have the exact numbers with, but they do recidivate at a lower level than those that have not had treatment or fail in treatment. And even those that have probably not completed treatment in prison but have been involved in treatment successfully right up to the time they leave prison also do better. But I do not have those exact numbers for you, but we can get them.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up. When you say that there's a lower rate, do you know if it's an appreciably lower rate?
It is significant enough to determine that it is beneficial for treatment, yes.
If you could, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Newman.
Provide me with the numbers. I'd be rather interested to know whether if we're going to spend $6 million every 2 years, whether it works or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, we'll provide that for you and the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, let's proceed. We do have another presenter after you. Thank you, Ms. Schrader.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, these first two items, the $330,000 to enhance the civil review commitment process and the $190,000 for timely revocation hearing, were part of the deficiency budget that I believe, the governor's deficiency budget that I believe has gone through both the House and the Senate and may be very close to appearing on the floor. In 2004, there was 1,484 cases that were reviewed. Of those, there is 241 predatory offender reports that were done, and 170 cases were forwarded to county attorneys for review for possible civil commit. These numbers are up dramatically. There was some changes in the policy. All level threes are referred, but we also widened the net and took a look at all the cases in 2004 and in 2005, because you're usually doing this 14 to 18 months before their release date, if at all possible. And those cases were screened and a number of times and were very closely looked at, and we feel that we have referred to the county attorneys for that legal screen now of those 170. Certainly not all of those 170 will meet that requirements for legal civil commitment, but we feel that the process has been dramatically improved so that nobody will slip through the cracks. The $190,000 for timely revocation hearings is adding two hearing officers, one support staff. The increase has been dramatic. Just in the last year, it went up 27%, the number of violations, revocation hearings. And over the last 6 years, it had gone up 73%. And so this was needed to make sure that we do have those hearings and that sex offenders don't be released because we're not able to provide them with timely hearings. $1.8 million is for intensive supervised release officers. We're looking at 18 agents. Six of those would be in Department of Corrections counties and the rural counties. There'd be 12 for the Community Correction Act counties that do their intensive supervised release. $162,000 is for GPS. That would be about 45 at any given day that would be on GPS tracking, either passive or active. And we have got a contract for that for $12 a day for passive and $17 a day for active GPS. We'd be looking mainly at those level 3 sex offenders that are released. $1.37 million is for housing, and we're looking for housing options. This was also mentioned in legislative auditor's report. is one of the major concerns for probation officers. If you have a sex offender that's homeless or is traveling from relative to relative or living out of the back of his car, it's very difficult to adequately supervise and manage that sex offender. And so this is a housing program that we're looking to ensure that there's the communities are safe as we're able to monitor and manage these sex offenders. And then the last one is Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, the $70,000 item on this page is basically reflects the cost of an additional position in our Office of Special Investigations Unit so that we can prepare hot files on all of our certainly level 3 sex offenders and probably level 2 and level 1 as well, so that if we do have someone abscond from supervision, we have a sheet ready to go in terms of where they live, where their girlfriend lives, where their relatives are at, so that we can rapidly apprehend these offenders. We believe that they're in the highest risk group, and this will give us the edge in terms of apprehending them.
Had you gotten through this slide? Okay, then we have two questioners, Representative Hillstrom, then Eastland. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had that window when the way we referred sex offenders for civil commitment was changing. Is there any money in this budget to take care of those offenders that kind of were in the process during the time of the change, or did all of that cost fall onto the counties?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Chairman Representative Hillstrom, not in our budget, to my knowledge. I know that in the supplemental budget last year that did not go through and pass, that I believe that in either DHS there was some money to help the counties, but I am not aware if that's included. It is not. It was not at that time in our budget, and I'm not familiar enough to know that if it's in the DHS budget or not. But you're talking about trying to assist the counties with some of those where they're holding them to be reviewed?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, we're talking about both about treatment in chemical dependency treatment or sex offender treatment, and it just kind of occurred to me, how do we determine what standards are applied to the kind of treatment that we get? I mean, in Department of Corrections, we kind of loosely say, well, we're doing chemical dependency treatment. What does that mean? Is there? If you're going to do that in other settings, you've got to be licensed. You've got to meet certain standards. How does the Department of Corrections interpret that? I mean, what do you call, when you say treatment? What does it mean?
Ms. Schrader, you're moving up to the table. Can you answer that for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we have certification rules, just like the community has to use. Our CD programs are certified, as are our sex offender programs. So we follow administrative rules. They were developed in conjunction, our CD rules were developed in conjunction with the Department of Human Services.
Representative Eastland.
So the DHS is the one that actually oversees the treatment programs that happen in the prison, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, no. They are rules that our commissioner is responsible for ensuring we're fulfilling appropriately, but they were developed in conjunction with DHS. There are certain things that, we developed them in conjunction with DHS, but there are rules.
Okay, so I guess the short answer is that there's you got some guidelines someplace, but there is no oversight except internally.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, that's correct.
There is no outside evaluations that are ever done of Department of Corrections treatment services.
Ms. Schrader, be careful. The last question was, you've got some rules and you have no guidance, and I thought you heard you say that's correct. So please listen to the question and know what you're answering.
Representative East.
The last question that I...
I'm sorry I interrupted, but go ahead and restate your question.
You interrupted my thought. No, I don't know if
that's what I wanted to.
I can get it back. My question was, is there outside evaluation of other than internally in the Department of Corrections itself that look at what the VLC is doing in the area of treatment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, yes, there is, by the Department of Human Services. In addition, we will be expecting that all of our CD staff are licensed alcohol and drug counselors. So they obviously have to follow their certification or their licensing regulations as well.
So then what you said then is a little different than what you said the first time. So the department, so the DHS does get involved directly in the chemical dependency treatment programs in corrections?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, they develop the rules in conjunction with us.
But they don't provide any oversight other than giving you the rules, correct? Okay, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Schrader, is there an evaluation or accountability component outlined in the rules?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you.
Okay, we have, thank you. We have two slides left if you want to proceed to wrap up. And we'll see if there's more questions.
Mr. Chair and members, this is really our last slide, and it's a change item request, and it basically is a placeholder amount for the governor's initiatives with respect to the methamphetamine sentencing increases and also the sex offender sentencing increases. $1.5 million for 06 and $3.3 million for 07. And again, this is at this point, it's still somewhat loosely defined in terms of what the bed impact will be, but obviously the bills with respect to methamphetamine and sex offenders are possibly going to result in additional beds, and these amounts are placeholders.
Any questions of the commissioner or the commissioners, deputy commissioners? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are two subjects that weren't really addressed in the budget, but they're part of the budget. I'm interested in MnCOR in particular. I know that the policy was that MnCOR was to be self-sufficient. My question is, how are you doing on that? And is there a surplus? And if so, how much?
Mr. Chair and members, the MnCOR was required to break even. We had a five-year plan to break even in prison industry. And this past year, our profit was around $2 million, the first year that we really made profit. The year before, it was about $147,000. So we're profitable finally after giving up the $6 million subsidy. And as we've said before, this is kind of the backbone of our programming in prisons. And the dollars that we make in MnCOR for the foreseeable future are going to have to go back into MnCOR as our population increases. Our business units are going to have to increase. We're also very aware of unfair competition out there. So we have a very diversified business program in terms of about 39 different businesses, different relationships, so that we don't infringe upon some of the private sector out there. That's always a concern. And obviously we need to employ as many people as possible, because it really is the cheapest security that we can buy. So our best customer, aside from ourselves, are other state agencies, governmental agencies. We also partner with private sector, where we would provide labor for a variety of different companies. And we're proud of the fact that we're finally at break-even, but we've got lots of work to do in terms of developing additional business units so that we can continue to employ more and more inmates, teach them those transferable skills. It's all part of our transitional process to try to get them involved in a meaningful work experience that's transferable once they are released from prison.
Mr. Chair.
Is that a pill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of as a follow-up, if we could kind of get the numbers and kind of see where you are, or are we, if we're going to talk about it here, that would be great. I thought maybe there was additional money. I had heard that there was additional money over that, and so I just would like to see the numbers. The second question that I have, I asked to sentencing before, but you're the proper people to ask. And do we get truth in sentencing money, and is that part of your budget? Given the fact that there's much discussion about going to indeterminate sentencing, I just want to know how much dollars there is, and if we get it, and how much it is.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, VOTUS dollars, Violent Offender Truth in Sentencing, has not been included in the federal budget for at least 2, maybe 3 years now. So there's no more money that comes to us that way, but you are correct. There was a hook there for that required Truth in Sentencing, but for at least 3 years, I believe, it has not been included in the President's budget.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for any of our witnesses, perhaps Commissioner Benson or whomever. Reviewing your presentation today, I was wondering if there's any specific monies dedicated to transitional reentry services. I know you mentioned for sex offenders specifically, but in general, are you asking for any sort of funding for reentry services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the money that we put up there is the amount that we've asked for additional, but I just last Friday convened a group of the other commissioners, Health, Human Services, Veterans, Jobs, and Employment, and we are looking to go for a grant. There's $300 million available for reentry grants, and so we're putting together a task force and are going to be looking for local partners as well. And we have to have this group together to apply for the money, and the National Institute of Corrections has come in to help facilitate that, and I think we have a real good shot at getting a good grant for reentry.
Representative Ellison.
That's excellent news. I'm really pleased to hear that, and I want to thank you and commend you and everybody in the corrections for doing that, and everybody all over for doing that, because I believe that every time somebody succeeds on reentry, you know, there's a victim who's not injured, and there's a dollar saved by the Minnesota taxpayers. So please continue in that direction and appreciate that work.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer it, you don't have to bring this up today and discuss it, but if you could get back to me. I was surprised to learn during the 80s when I was examining where our church money was going to our district that there was a program, a sexual offender program, where they were actually desensitizing sex offenders in a professional manner by certified counselors by showing them graphic images, photographs, and movies of hardcore pornography. And I was just wondering if you could get back to me on the basics of your sex offender treatment there, if anything ever, maybe a schematic of what they go through. But I was surprised. I didn't believe it, so I called up and talked to the sex offender program director, and she stated that was true. They were desensitizing the subject on this program. So unless you want to answer it now, I just...
This calls for a field trip, I think.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that's not happening in the
program. Okay. Mr. Chairman, is that the program where they show them the pornography and then shock them if they react to it or something? Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know what they did after they showed it to them, but there was everything imaginable that described to me, and it was hard for me to believe.
To the best of my knowledge, that's not happening any place in Minnesota.
We cut them off in the Treasury funds.
Okay, we're going to close, I think, with this last Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for Commissioner Fabian. This doesn't necessarily go to your budget, but since I have you here, I wanted to ask you because this really bugs me. I was reading the Attorney General's budget request this morning, and your department is mentioned rather prominently in there. I imagine you've seen it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He essentially accuses your department of some pretty significant malfeasance, maybe even violation of the law with respect to civil commitment issues. And I believe that part of the Attorney General's job is to represent agencies. So he's your lawyer and you're his client. Is that how you have always understood it, at least?
That's the way it's supposed to be, yes.
Okay. I don't have a problem with an attorney telling their client that they think they're doing something wrong privately. But to me, it seems like there's a pretty significant ethical lapse for an attorney publicly attacking his client. And I'd like your thoughts on that, and I guess I'm just curious, are you finding your attorney's services useful these days or not?
Mr. Chair, do I have to answer that?
Maybe that was more of a statement.
Commissioner Fabian, I'm a very kind and lenient chairman. I'll let you answer the question any way you choose, within reason, and if you can do it within a few seconds. Commissioner Fabian, that's a legitimate question, I suppose. You feel free to answer it any way you want to.
We are obviously concerned about what's going on with the Attorney General, and I totally disagree with what he said in his statements. We have been following the law carefully, and I'm glad that he is getting two more, if he gets the attorneys that he's requested, because we have asked that he step up to the plate and provide a legal screen so that so many of the cases don't have to go to the county attorney. So I guess, we certainly haven't resolved everything that we need to resolve, but I very strongly disagree with what he said.
Thank you for coming, all three of you, Commissioner Fabian. Deputy Commissioners, thank you. Committee, we're going to move on to the tax court, and I'd ask you to come forward, Chief Judge Perez. Ms. Henley. We'll wait a minute till we, those of us who want to clear out may do so.
New people?
What's that?
Got any new people working for you?
Same old, same old. I think we're reasonably intact here. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is George Perez. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. And to my left, your right, is Sheldon Henley, who's the Court Administrator. And just very briefly, the Tax Court is comprised of three judges, including myself, and three staff people. We operate statewide jurisdiction. We hear cases from all 87 counties. We travel to all 87 counties, not all in 1 year, but over a transgression of various years. We hear two types of cases primarily, and those are commissioner cases, which are all appeals that are generated from the Department of Revenue. And we also hear cases that are called property tax appeals that are generated from the various counties. We have also engaged in collection tax cases that the Commissioner of Revenue has sent over to us over the last couple of years. We have read and reviewed the governor's recommended budget, and we are fairly satisfied with it. There is a modest deficit that would need to be addressed or added, but there are no other.
Justice Perez, you and I talked about that deficit just a day or two ago. You want to get right to that? The way I hear it, the balance of the bulk of all of the recommendations are okay except for the deficit.
Yes.
That you identified for me. Go ahead and just get right to that.
Yes. The deficit can be broken down into the 2 years. For the biennium. For 06, there's a $25,000 deficit, and for 07, there's a $50,000 deficit. And that, again, is not any new money or additional money for any kind of programming, which there is no programming conducted by the court. It's simply money that's used to operate and run the court for salaries and rent and office supplies.
Any questions from anyone? I'll think I have any. Representative Paymeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When's the last time that the filing fees have been increased?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the filing fees were last increased in the last legislative biennium session.
So the fee is, $235? Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. And if I may add, the fees that are charged are also consistent with what's charged with the district courts as well.
Representative Paymeyer, for what it's worth, I've asked the justice to, we discussed the issue of a separate fee increase for his court, not touching the other courts in the state. I believe the brief information I've got is there's 3,000 number of cases is
approximately
3,000 cases, so it looks like a $15 increase across the board for filing fees in this court would more than offset or make up for the deficit. So I've asked for that information. When we get some specifics, I'm probably going to ask that we consider that for what it's worth. Anything else? Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
I just have one, Mr. Chair. Judge Perez, do you have any open positions in your court, in your office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have a law clerk position that we have been able to fill, which we are the only court in the state of Minnesota that does not have law clerks. And I know many of you have a law degree and know the significance of that. And we have functioned essentially without that, meaning that the judges do their own research and writing and we primarily welcome that challenge, but we nevertheless have had to do without that assistance, and we have requested that in the past. We certainly don't intend to request it at this point, understanding the budget deficit overall that the state faces, but that is something that we have asked about in the past.
Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Just a statement, Mr. Chair, on that. I would like to remind the committee that we funded the law clerk position in 2001 appropriation, and so that's the opening, and that's how they've been covering their lack of new money, in my opinion.
Representative Murphy, I'll add to that for what it's worth. I personally value the work of the tax court. I know some states don't have it. we didn't always, and it just to be reminded from the justice just the other day, frankly, it saves a lot of time to be able to carve those cases out of district court and have judges who can focus on those cases and have some expertise. And maybe we can join forces and explore ways to provide the funds necessary to do what's needed here.
I would like that, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? If not, this meeting is adjourned.